First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Is Florida ready for Hurricane Ian? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a closer look at the path of the storm and whether the state's hurricane prep, not to mention its property insurance market, is where it needs to be. 549-2937 to give us a call with your thoughts. Then later, the Jaguars get a big win on the road. Our Josh Torres with that. And some other news and notes to get into this morning. But let's begin with our big story this morning. Unpredictable Hurricane Ian. It strengthened overnight as it churned out in the Caribbean, prompting urgent preparations here in Florida. Now, this storm could deliver real impacts, including tornadoes, starting tomorrow before possibly coming ashore as a major hurricane with powerful winds and dangerous storm surge. Even as Ian grows stronger with sustained winds at 75 miles an hour, there remains higher than usual certainty. It's Monday. Let me get this right, folks. Higher than usual uncertainty over Ian's track and intensity. That's according to the National Hurricane Center. Okay, so here are two questions for us to ponder. Are we ready for this storm in terms of traditional hurricane prep? And then more importantly, how is our property insurance market, which needs major shoring up, going to respond if this storm has real impacts? A.G. Gankarski of our own Jax Today and Florida Politics has been looking into this and how Ian is also affecting the political world, and he's on the line. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right, folks, let us know your thoughts about Hurricane Ian. Are you getting ready out there? Are you concerned at all about your property insurance, your insurance policy at your home or business? 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Well, of course, Florida Ron DeSantis says the entire state needs to prepare for Ian, A.G. Here in our corner of Florida, we're expected to be on the east side of the storm. That's never a good side to be on with hurricanes. So at this point, I guess anything goes as the state prepares for its first major hurricane of the season.
Yeah, and there's still a lot of uncertainty in the models. I mean, I've seen models that take the storm, you know, to off the Atlantic coast near us. That's a couple of, you know, deviant models. There are models, most of them seem to converge the I-75 area, give or take, west. So for us, that would make it a rain, a wind event, but not a catastrophic event. But that doesn't mean we'd be out of the woods, because it's going to be a multi-day event. It's going to be much like Irma was 5 years ago, trudging up and you know, creating a lot of havoc. And if you're in a low-lying area and you were here 5 years ago and you remember how the flooding happened, it could happen again. And you know, this is going to be a severe test for our local infrastructure, you know, for our drainage specifically, and so on. But just because we're not getting a direct hit from the storm in all likelihood does not mean we're not going to be hit by the storm, because, I mean, I just think back to 5 years ago, the post-Irma period, that recovery was not short at all.
Yeah, I'll never forget watching from our windows here at WJCT. We are on the banks of the St. John's River, watching the river overflow its banks, water encircling our entire building, flowing across Bay Street and encircling TIAA Bank Field completely. You know, that was something that I don't think any of us who were here covering that storm will ever forget. 5 years on from that, AG, how do you see not just local officials, but the state in general working to better prepare for this new era we're in, where inland flooding is a bigger concern than ever? Of course, this state has long experience dealing with storm surge and high winds, but we're only expected to be having this more frequently and more regularly with warming oceans. And, you know, how prepared do you think Florida is in terms of shoring up sustainability efforts to deal with the kind of flooding that we can expect?
I think it's been a very limited, cursory preparation given the resources the state has and the money and time spent on other priorities. I mean, we've heard so many culture war priorities time and time again, but the infrastructure resiliency, you know, has taken a back seat, and we've seen the results. And, you know, adding to this is a lot of permitting issues. I mean, we see a lot of builds on areas that should not be built on currently and in previous economic booms. And when you look at those issues, those convergences, it raises a lot of questions about, you know, how we're going to deal with not just this storm, but with these seeming changes in weather patterns. I mean, we've seen torrential rain all season. So unlike a year where you might see a hurricane after a drought period, this is one where we've got a lot of water in the ground table, things like that, the water table. So it really worries me. Flooding from this storm here and elsewhere strikes me as an existential concern, especially in these older neighborhoods that have not seen the remediation and capital budgets they could have used.
Let's talk about older neighborhoods in this area alone that deal with this in such a terrible way, particularly the north and west sides of Jacksonville. I also think Black Creek, an area south of downtown Clay County. There are neighborhoods down there that always get slammed by these high waters. And for decades now, there have been calls to improve infrastructure in certain areas that haven't always been heeded. And so what about people in those neighborhoods that are really going to face the brunt of this water?
Yeah, they've got some tough decisions to make, decisions that could involve sandbags or evacuation. And it remains to be seen what evacuation centers will actually be open this time. It's a sort of a post-COVID era, and things are different. So, you know, the reaction to a storm like this, but, I mean, if you're in one of the, you know, flood zones that typically gets flooding, you know, you're going to deal with it again. And, and this does affect these neighborhoods that have suffered from the broken promises of consolidation writ large. You know, part of the consolidation deal in the 60s was there would be infrastructural investment in these areas as part of changing the county government. These promises are slow in delivery. And even with, you know, massive, you know, relatively speaking, capital improvement budgets, it's still a race against time and a race against decades of delayed investment and, you know, functional neglect. And it really worries me for these older neighborhoods yet again with this storm.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with A.G. Gankarski of Jax Today and Florida Politics. Are you ready for Ian? Did you go to the store over the weekend to see there was no bottled water anywhere to be found? Have you started making a hurricane kit? Do you have a plan in case you need to evacuate? What are your concerns about your property insurance? Give us a call at 549-2937. Let's talk about the state's property insurance market for a bit, AG. You know, there have been louder and louder concerns about how sound it is. Here's a tweet from Andrew. He says, I think on the whole, the insurance market will be able to better withstand Ian than other storms with recently passed reforms that will limit litigation, which is the big reason for the issues we have today, he says. Okay, so the legislature did take a whack at property insurance reform. Did they succeed?
Well, you know, I think that question can be asked, you know, more subjectively. If you're a homeowner right now, do you have confidence in this property insurance market going through the storm, knowing that carriers are withdrawing from the state, that Florida is considered to be increasingly risky because of building patterns, because of storm patterns, like we've been discussing, and these issues? You know, you see an envelope in the mail from your insurance company, and the first thing you think is, are they saying they're not going to renew coverage? This has placed a lot of burden on citizens, the state insurer of last resort. And it's ironic that in the free state of Florida with free market solutions for everything touted, the insurance market has been such a state of collapse that we're having to expand a state insurer. And, you know, that sounds like a workaround in theory, but if you have a home that's, you know, a high dollar home, and I mean, we've seen property appreciation over the last couple of years that has really increased the values of ordinary properties, then you may not be able to get full coverage. You know, getting that claim satisfied, that will be interesting too, because this market's been larded, you know, the citizens' customer base has been larded in a time with relatively less storm activity in Florida. So this is definitely a test of the special session reforms. I mean, you can say it's all about roofing like the insurance company does and about roof scams. And, you know, that notwithstanding, that doesn't provide comfort for the people who actually need it. And it seems like massive deflection from the insurance industry and from lawyers to just put it, you know, on the idea of the roof claims. This is where the insurance industry is either going to have to step up and deliver or withdraw from the state. Mm-hmm. And that will be catastrophic because, you know, the storm impacts, let's say it lands in Tampa, goes to Orlando. How much damage? I mean, that'll be catastrophic record-setting damage. And that could destabilize the market. And, you know, the fact that DeSantis, and they had the special session, it was a Band-Aid. And that Band-Aid hasn't had time to actually heal the wound. And that's a problem for the state.
Not only that, according to the Insurance Information Institute, Florida has the highest property insurance rates now in the nation. Many Floridians feel fortunate at this point simply to have coverage for their home, which is most people's number one investment. Not comforting as Ian bears down. Let's go to your calls, 549-2937. Hope in Riverside. Hello, Hope.
Hi, Melissa. I appreciate you all, you and AG, shining a light on sort of the lack of investment historically within certain communities here in Jacksonville. And I think shining a light on what happened 5 years ago is important if we will pay attention to the lessons of that moment. I think about communities like the Ken Knight Drive community where lots of promises have been made, including since the storm. The city received significant dollars, millions of dollars, to repair homes or to buy out homes, neither of which has ever occurred, leaving dozens, even hundreds of people in limbo. And so I think some of the policies that have been placed for a long time since consolidation in marginalized communities is still playing out in places like Ken Knight Drive today. And we need to be asking the questions of where did all that money go?
Thank you for that. Where did that money go? A.G. Gankarski, I don't think we have a clear answer.
Yeah, I mean, we really don't. I mean, it clearly hasn't been earmarked for that purpose. And, I mean, I'm going off the top of my head here. I believe there was one buyout project that happened, you know, in the Southside area. But, yeah, we haven't seen activity like that.
So I think you're talking about South Shores on the south near the south bank of the St. John's River?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, these buyout projects, it's never as simple as that because every homeowner's got their own calculus about what they want to do. And people can, you know, people are idiosyncratic. But, yeah, it's obvious that areas like Ken Knight Drive are going to deal with this issue again. It's obvious that the money and the wherewithal hasn't been spent to remedy it. And these buyouts need to be considered on these properties that traditionally flood, because it's not just about the domicile itself. It's about mold issues, about things like that. If you get mold in your home, you know, because you got flooding, and a few years down the line, your lungs don't work because you got mold poisoning, this is not something that is unusual in this area. So, you know, we have to consider the long-term effects of these things, but you got flood-prone properties. People should not be living in them in the way they are now. And, you know, there's got to be a solution that government helps with.
549-2937, Brian in St. Augustine. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
All right. Thanks for calling. Ready for Ian?
I hope so. We trimmed some trees and, you know, did some prep work and got rid of everything around the house. But my homeowner's insurance canceled me, and they had contacted me a couple months ago and said my roof is over 15 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I needed to get a home inspector, which I did. I got a certified home inspector to check the roof out, and he said that it's got more than 5 years of life left on it, took pictures, sent it in 30 days before their drop-dead date. They ignored my home inspection report, didn't reply to me, and then just canceled me. So
right.
I'm in talks with them now. But is that even something they can do? Is that legal?
You know, Brian, I'm so glad you called, and I'm so sorry that that's happening to you, because unfortunately, your story is a very common one. We've been seeing this all over the state, homeowners being dropped by their insurers under the guise of the insurer arguing that the roof is getting too old. That leaves guys like Brian completely in the lurch, scrambling to find home insurance AG. So this is a common tactic we're seeing from insurers. Is it legal? What should Brian do other than go into the citizen's bucket, the insurer of last resort?
That's likely one solution for him. I would assume that the insurance company is following the letter of the law in sending out.
If not the
like
spirit
that.
Of the law, yeah.
Right. I mean, there's no spirit of the law here. I mean, these companies are scared of the risk. And the roofing issue, I mean, you know, back when you might have bought your roof, you might have said, well, this is a 25, 30-year roof. That may not necessarily be the case with Florida roofs. You know, that's one issue. You know, can people really replace their roofs every 10 years? I mean, that seems to be what the insurance industry wants. It feels to me, and this is the sort of a subjective impression, that the roof canard is a way for insurance companies to get out of the contract, create an impossible demand on the roof. And any independent inspectors, ombudsman's role to the contrary is going to be ignored. That illustrates the fear that a lot of people have right now. I mean, a lot of us are Brian right now.
Absolutely.
We don't have bargaining power with these companies.
Yeah, I mean, to cite once again the sort of the Bible of this, the Insurance Information Institute, this seems to be a move by the companies to hedge their bets due to fraudulent roofing claims that have roiled the state's property insurance market. And you know, when you talk to lawmakers in Tallahassee, AG, they say they're telling people to be patient, that the property insurance reforms they enacted in their special legislative session will take a little time to take effect. But that's cold comfort for people who are being dropped right now in the middle of hurricane season.
Yeah, and really that's malpractice on any legislator's part who are telling people to relax and just wait it out. You know, given the fact that many people bought homes as the market was going up, and you know, with money getting more expensive with interest rates, you know, going up, there's no indication that trend's going to stop. You don't really have the flexibility to just up and move unless you're, say, a legislator who comes from a family with millions of dollars. So yeah, that's sort of the paradox of this, is that people are basically, they don't have options. And, you know, the solution is years in development. And that's not going to help people who are suffering from this storm, or, you know, suffering from insurance companies looking at the storm and saying, okay, we're out of the state. You know, even if you don't have a claim on your house, even if your house is relatively, you know, safe, et cetera, you know, it's a lack of appetite for the market.
Now, in the midst of all of this, Ian, worry and preparation, politicians have sort of put the brakes on their campaigns this week, although this issue of property insurance reform has become a campaign talking point for some candidates, right?
Yeah, I mean, Charlie Crist is... you know, basically say he's going to get tough with the insurers and things like that. I'm not really sure what the CRIST reforms as they're proposed would do.
He said on this problem he'd lower our rates. That was the big promise he made.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how the state enforces that mechanism without subsidizing citizens and making it basically state-run property insurance, which would be something that would raise equitability claims to renters who wouldn't benefit from that. So it's really something where there's no easy solution because, you know, if you're going to have a free market insurance industry, they're going to set the rates, they're going to determine whether they want to be in the space or not. And, you know, they're not going to assume risk just because a politician shakes their fist at. And that is the defect in the CRIST proposal. It sounds good, it makes for a good press conference or a good ad or whatever, but it wouldn't fix the fundamental issue. And the fundamental issue is basically insurers don't want to play in a sandbox anymore.
Yeah, and of course, the long-term ramifications of that are what we all need to be thinking about. There will be political blowback at some point, don't you think, though, if more and more insurers keep fleeing this state? How does Florida market itself as a sunny paradise, a haven for retirees, a tourism mecca, if you can't insure anything here?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. I mean, Florida's been a boom and bust place historically, and we've always tried to find a way out of it, trying to find more manufacturing, all that, but it always comes down to tourism and people wanting to make this place a destination. And yeah, you saw a lot of influx of population the last couple of years, a lot of remote workers or people, you know, attracted here for culture war reasons or what have you. It's a rude awakening when the place is more expensive to live in California or the Northeast, because when you add up things like, you know, the hidden cost of property insurance or this, that, and the other, it adds up quickly. So you don't get the affordability in Florida anymore. But with the lack of ability to insure your investment, The legislature and Governor DeSantis had better hope that their special session fixes actually bear fruit in the coming years.
That's
what I have to say about that.
Josh tweets the show, if there was ever a case for government to step in where the free market fails, this is it. If we did not have some government intervention, homeowners would be left completely to the whims of insurance companies, he says. David on the line in Jacksonville. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa, and hey, AG, I appreciate the conversation. It's a concern, though. You know, our heart goes out, those of us who are engaged in the insurance industry, our heart goes out to the stories of some of your callers who are having to deal with being canceled or having to deal with being rewritten when their company goes out of business in a climate where, by the way, we have had no wind blowing. I mean, realize people talk about Florida is such a worrisome state because of the wind, but the reality is we haven't even had to face that. And this crisis is one that is a man-made crisis. It's one that the dynamics in Florida are very different than every other state, not just because of the hurricane risk, but because of court rulings and the legislature's failure to act to create a level playing field. And so, you know, insurance.
What would that look, David? David, what would that look like? A level playing
field? Well, there are two main things. There are one-way attorney fees, which create an unlevel playing field. Normally, if the attorney loses a case, they have to pay the other guy, or they have to pay the other guy's attorney's fees. In Florida, when it comes to insurance companies, it's the only place in this country where attorneys get a free pass. And in addition to that, there have been fee multipliers where they get bonuses for suing insurance companies. So the reality, what we've seen is this proliferation of lawsuits. In fact, when you look at it, 70% of all of the lawsuits in the country for homeowners litigated claims happen in Florida. Mm. So that's the big issue. So what happens? Insurance companies, they would love to be on risks, but they can't be on risks where they're going to be facing these lawsuits and where they're going to be facing fraudulent roof claims. where people all over, it's become just a norm for people to be able to say, oh, I'm getting a free roof. Someone knocked on my door. And that's not okay. I mean, it's causing the whole industry to be in crisis.
I really appreciate your thoughts, David. Thanks for that call. Terry tweets the show, if insurance were simply no longer available, what would be the reaction of mortgage companies that require property insurance? Well, of course, AG, you have to extrapolate this out and think about the fact that at a certain point, you won't be able to write a 30-year mortgage on a home in Florida. You just won't be able to.
Yeah. I mean, there are some Band-Aid solutions from some mortgage companies where, you know, they will advance a sort of like insurance that pads onto your mortgage. And that's not a real solution either. Yeah, I mean, you know, this gets down to the issues of, you know, is the investment worth the risk? And, you know, it's hard to make a 30-year bet on a Florida property or structure right now. And the issues, I want to address this briefly because David made some very good points. And, you know, but issues like fee multipliers and the roof claim, these have been litigated in Tallahassee, you know, from one speaker to another, from one Senate president to another, and there's no appetite to fix those issues, you know, on the legislative. I mean, that's why the special session was as limited as it was, like, okay, this is what we can do. And it's basically, it's not enough. And that's going to be proven, I fear, over the coming weeks and months and year.
Always good to get your insights. AG, thanks for being with us. And everybody batten down the hatches, as they say. Let's hope it's not a really bad storm. Thanks, AG.
Be safe.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Much more still ahead later. Some good news. The Jaguars are on a roll. Plus, season two of our new program, What's Health Got to Do With It? But up next.
So my dad had a lot of contacts with people like Winn-Dixie and Publix and Safeway. He made him a broker, believe it or not, to sit by his pool and make phone calls and sell their products to his old customers.
First Coast Success profiles a local firm with ties to a big national brand. We'll be right back. They're a local company with ties to a beloved national brand, Ready Whip. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jack's Daily Record speaks with Andy Block, CEO of Rubik's Foods Dairy Fair.
Andy Block is the CEO of Jacksonville-based Rubik's Foods, which was known as Dairy Fair before rebranding a year ago. The privately owned food science company opened its new innovation center this week in Flagler Center. You probably have tasted the products it developed for major food chains. It traces its industry roots to 1910, when Andy Block's great-grandfather started a canning company in the Bronx in New York. You might know it better by a product his grandfather co-founded, Ready Whip. Andy Block, welcome to First Coast Success.
Karen, thank you for having me this morning.
We must start with Ready Whip. Please share that story.
When my great-grandfather sold his business to Vita Foods back in the 1930s, they were transferred to Chicago to work for the Vita Foods company. About 1947, a gentleman named Buddy Lappin, who was an inventor, came up with the first disposable aerosol can. He didn't have any food experience, so he reached out to the industry and found my grandfather. Grandfather was very interested in starting his own business again, so he partnered with Buddy Lappin and moved to Jacksonville in 1947 to start the first Ready Whip processing plant.
And where was that?
Down here on the South Bank, where the old Steinmart building is and the current Hanania building is.
Well, your father, Mickey Block, also is a developer, and he developed a revolutionary way to extend the shelf life of dairy products. What was that?
So my father brought in the first extended dairy shelf life rig back in the 60s from Europe. Europe had aseptic technology, which was shelf-stable technology. We did not have that here in the U.S. So he imported a UHT processing rig here to the United States, built his new facility down in Beaver Street Foods and started producing products that extended shelf life with high temperature from 14 days to 60-day shelf life.
And that manufacturing plant exists today?
That manufacturing plant is owned by Danone today. His old company was called Long Life Dairy Products.
Well, then came Dairy Fair. How did that come about?
So when my dad sold Long Life Dairy Products and my grandfather in 1979 to Beatrice, he worked for the company for several years. After that, he got a call from a friend with a group called Mid-America Dairymen, today Dairy Farmers of America, a very large cooperative. And they needed help selling products at a few facilities. So my dad had a lot of contacts with people like Winn-Dixie and Publix and Safeway. And they made him a broker, believe it or not, to sit by his pool and make phone calls and sell their products to his old customers. He got so busy, needed an office and a secretary, and lo and behold, Dairy Fair Foods was formed. If he never got that call, we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking today.
Well, you and your brothers have been running the company now for, I believe, 14 years?
Yes.
And 3 years ago, you partnered with Arbor Investments. What happened then? What was Dairy Fair before, and what are you doing now?
So over the last 15 years, we've really taken away the commodity side of our business and gone into the value-added side of our business. So we produce products with flavor and high functional ingredients for national restaurant chains and large industrial manufacturers. So as we continued to grow that business, we hired more chefs, more food scientists, and really got into the culinary side of the business. In order to continue to expand that business with a family business, sometimes it's difficult making the right decisions to invest back into the business. You know, the consensus is sometimes very difficult to get to. So we all agreed that a partner would help us accelerate the business. So we did a very large search throughout the industry. Took well over a year. Narrowed it down to a few people, and we decided Arbor was our best partner. So we struck a deal with them in April 30th of 2019, and part of their vision was to transform our company from a dairy-related company into a newer culinary-focused company. So a name change was in our future. In addition, they wanted us to have a state-of-the-art facility to showcase our incredible capabilities. So that was all decided pre-acquisition. We all agreed to that, and over the last 3 years, they've been a tremendous help in helping us transform our company. These guys are not necessarily operators, but they understand business on how to transform your business better to the marketplace. So over the last 3 years, we've done a full rebrand, full name change, and we've just moved into our new 50,000 square foot innovation center.
What is the genesis of Rubik's? How did that name come about?
We went through probably 1,000 different names, and we just really couldn't come up with a consensus of a name. Well, our marketing department actually came up with that name, and we just all seemed to like it. It had a good ring to it. They really want to showcase the block name, and, you know, Rubik's being a block. So we just kind of took that name and ran with it, and it's really taken effect into the industry. People now know us as Rubik's Foods.
And Andy Block, you are CEO of Rubik's Foods. Tell me about the Innovation Center.
Sure. So our innovation is absolutely state-of-the-art, one of a kind in the industry. Our focus is speed to market. That's what we're really focused on. So we basically built a facility to accelerate the testing process, the development process, the showcase process. So when you walk into our Innovation Center, we have a state-of-the-art show kitchen. We have a state-of-the-art R&D facility that includes sensory, includes workbenches, includes labs. Every facet of the process is inside the facility, so we can bring a customer in there and cut down what takes them months into days.
Now, I know you cannot identify the customers, but give us a hint about where we might be tasting your products.
So we do a lot of work with what we call QSR, quick service restaurants. So you'll know a lot of the names out there. And you might be eating my spicy glaze on a chicken sandwich, or you might be eating, you know, my flavor systems on a French fry or a burger or another chicken sandwich. So we also do a lot of casual dining restaurants as well. And we do some high-end restaurants. So we have a very large footprint in large industrial manufacturers where we are a functional ingredient that goes into further processed foods that typically end up in retail and some chain restaurants as well. I say it to all people, if you eat my product 1,000 times, you just don't know it because we're not a branded company on the retail shelf.
And I think everybody probably has tasted the sour cream in those little packets.
Right. Yeah, that was where we started a long time ago. It's actually called a tetrahedron, and it's actually the smallest amount of packaging you could put the most amount of product into. So it's a very unique package, and we've been doing that package for over 30 years.
Now, your brother, Jeffrey, he said that Jacksonville is one of the country's top test markets. Why is that?
I think it's due to the demographics here. I mean, a lot of the QSRs focus on a certain age, a certain income, and Jackson was a very diverse group. We have a lot of young people. We have a lot of old people. We got all different types of people, and it just seems for some reason the chain restaurants have geared in on Jacksonville as one of the top five test markets, and it's been that way for as long as I can remember. So I'm not really 100% sure why, but it is a major test market in the U.S.
And you have a sensory panel, a testing panel at the Innovation Center.
Correct. So we're able to bring the right demographics of the customer that they need in order to test the product very quickly. So if you're a chain restaurant and your demographics might be 25-year-old to 40-year-old, more women, less men, certain incomes, we can gear down on those particular people, invite them into the facility, and then answer the question the customer really wants answered quickly to give them back the feedback they need to move forward or not move forward with the project.
Today's segment of First Coast Success is brought to you by First Horizon.
Well, our fabulous local medical show, What's Health Got to Do With It, kicked off its second season this weekend. Host Dr. Joe Servin is here in studio with a look back at season one and what we can expect in season two. Hey, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. So good to be here with you.
And congrats on this show. It's taken off and it's fantastic.
Oh, Melissa, thank you so much. We're so excited. And most importantly, excited that we get to help folks in a very different way. And that, I think, is the passion for myself and the whole team.
The whole idea behind this show is to guide the listener through the medical bureaucracy and also look at how healthcare intersects with your daily life. This is something that is of interest to everyone because everyone's had an experience with that and not a good one.
So true, Melissa. I mean, the reason my family will often say, like, you know, do you have enough topics? I go, do we have enough topics? Like, yeah. I think that it just pick something and we can do it. But that's the whole point. How do we navigate a very, very complicated health system?
You know, and in this first season, you've had some amazing guests, including NPR host Diane Rehm on the Death with Dignity movement. She was just on the show. Mary Daniel, a Jacksonville advocate for patients. She became a national figure after she started working at her husband's long-term care facility where her husband was living in the middle of the pandemic. And so many other interesting voices that you've had on to spotlight all of these healthcare issues.
It's been a true honor to be able to get folks of this caliber who want to share and really not only share, but also give a sense of like direction to others in terms of how to kind of help people who may find themselves in the same boat that they found themselves in. And I think those are the heroes of healthcare that we get to highlight.
Now, of course, you're a neurologist at Mayo Clinic. How did you decide that you wanted to expand your healthcare work into broadcasting?
You know, that's a great question. One of the things that's always been a passion for me is one of the reasons I went into medicine, how do I get to help folks? And I love helping the ones I get to see on a day-by-day basis. But this was a way to kind of use a different muscle, a different skill set. And I thought maybe reach out a little bit more to folks larger than someone who has to meet me in an appointment type setting over a limited amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've reached so many people already. Let's talk about the new season. You kicked it off Saturday. What do you have on tap for season two?
We are going to be doing a bit of what we did in our first season, get to talk to some heroes. We started out with our monthly medical roundtable, which is something that we do by the title. Every month, we get a great group of medical experts, and we pull out the headlines of whatever's going on in healthcare. And this is actually fascinating to me because I don't know what others are thinking, and we get to hear it from different specialists and different perspectives. We have some great guests, including the AMA president, the American Medical Association's president, when he comes here to Jacksonville, sit down and talk to us about what's going on in healthcare from a national perspective. And just so many more, plus lots of book authors and other folks who are just trying to kind of figure out how do we keep ourselves healthy and out of the hospital and out of the health system, to be blunt with you.
That's the goal, isn't it? I mean, is to put guys like you out of business.
Exactly, exactly. And I'll take, and I don't take it personally, please.
I mean, honestly, that it's why I take supplements. It's why I have started eating a more plant-based diet, not 100% of the time, but at least some of the time. You know, it's why I do these little things every day, because my big goal in life now is to stay healthy. I don't want to be in the hospital. I don't want a lot of medical bills. I've seen what happens with friends and relatives who, as they got older, it just took over their lives in such a terrible way. So I think that that is something on a lot of people's minds right now.
I think at the end, I have the same approach, Melissa. I've tried to switch to plant-based. Mm-hmm. I want to keep myself as healthy as I can. And tell people, you know, I'm not saying it's always easy, but just to be able to do it. So exactly what you're saying. So I don't have to be on the other side of that exam room table.
Yeah. So with all of that said, here's how you can listen to What's Health Got to Do with It. It's every Saturday at 4 o'clock on the radio here on WJCT News 89.9. It re-airs Sunday nights at 9 p.m. You can also stream it on demand through the WJCT app, all major podcast platforms. So now that you're a celebrity, what's it like for you, Dr. Joe, as you go about your life and you're hanging out around town?
Well, I will tell you, Melissa, that I have a family that got, let's just say, grounds me very much and reminds me to go and pick up the things at the store like anybody else right there.
Very nice. Well, Dr. Joe Servin, it's a pleasure to have you as part of our WJCT family, and keep listening out for new episodes of What's Health Got to Do with It. Thanks again, and have fun with it.
Hey, thanks so much, Melissa. I've always appreciate it.
When we come back, after years of losing to the Chargers on the road, the Jaguars notch up a win. Our Josh Torres has a look at the Jaguars changing fortunes and some more sports news and notes right after this. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
Hi, join me, Dr. Joe Servin, for What's Health Got to Do with It, a weekly program that examines where and how healthcare intersects with your daily life. Tune in Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9.
Amelia Island celebrates all things jazz at the Amelia Island Jazz Fest, October 2nd through 9th. Join us for a community concert, headlining concerts, late-night jams, dance nights, and jazz brunch. Information at AmeliaIslandJazzFestival.com. Lee & Kate's Glass, family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee & Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com. Scenic Jacksonville presents the Great City Symposium on October 12th. Bob Buckhorn, former mayor of Tampa, Florida, shares how he transformed downtown Tampa and its riverfront over the last decade. Tickets at scenicjacksonville.com.
Experience the wonder and power of live symphonic music with the Jacksonville Symphony. With beloved symphonic blockbusters, sensational new works, and everything in between, there's always something for everyone. Learn more about the Jacksonville Symphony at jacksymphony.org.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. School libraries are turning into a battlefield as some 1,600 books are being challenged across the country.
The best thing about talking about these books is the fact at least we're talking about reading.
We'll talk with two moms, one from each side of the debate over banned books. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Critics are accusing Republican governors of using migrants as political pawns. Their backers say Joe Biden is to blame for leaving those who run southern border states with far too many pieces to play with. As cities brace for thousands more asylum seekers to arrive, could the crisis shift attention back to finding a solution, or should we expect more political stunts? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, after years of losing to the Chargers on the road, the Jaguars rolled to victory yesterday. Josh Torres is here with a wrap-up. Hey, Josh.
Hey there, Melissa.
All right, so a statement win for the team. What are your thoughts about the game and how the team is looking now?
I mean, Melissa, there's so much you can say about this team. I mean, they are just clicking on every cylinder. As I've said before, as someone who's lived in this city his entire life, this is something I've never seen, really. I mean, just to throw some stuff out, this is their first 30-point game since September of 2020. It snaps a road losing streak of 18 games that dated back to 2019. Mm-hmm. And, Melissa, one of the craziest things I saw was this is the first time since the year 2000 that they've won back-to-back games by at least 20. In 2000, I was in kindergarten just to show people like how long it has been since we've seen something like this.
But pretty exciting for a lifelong Jags fan.
It very much is exciting for fans. The fact that this team is now going from having the first overall pick to now they've won back-to-back games by 20 after dropping their first game. And just both sides of the ball are working so well, and it's great to see.
Really, really cool to see. What does this say about new head coach Doug Peterson and what he's brought to the locker room?
I mean, it clearly shows that the team is buying into the message that him and his staff are providing them. Last week, he was on the Rich Eisen show, and he talked about how one of the mottos he's been using this year is "So what, now what?" as a way of showing his guys, like, we got to leave whatever happened in the past, and we got to move forward. If we lose a game, okay, what did we do wrong? What can we do better? If we win a game, what went right in that game, and what do we need to do to get even better from that? And you can, it shows, like, these guys, you see how poised Trevor Lawrence is in the pocket, how suffocating the defense is, even after they give up a big play, they still come at you with that same tenacity. And it's really showing that this team is gelling and has really bought into that message of who cares, everybody thinks we're going to lose, let's go out and let's prove people wrong. And now people are talking about Doug Peterson can very well be coach of the year. The team is 2-1, we're 3 games into the season, and now he's being thrown around as a possible coach of the year candidate because of what they're seeing and the change in the offense and how well Trevor Lawrence is doing now. It's really showing us why he was the number one overall pick. And the defense has forced in 3 games Ole Miss as many turnovers as they did all of last season. And so the team is just really clicking, and it's a very exciting time to be a Jags fan.
It really is. Okay, so another wild weekend for college ball. Give us your rundown there.
Yeah, so we had Georgia, number one overall team in the country. They definitely were tested this week against Kent State. They still pulled out a fairly decisive victory, but there were times when Kent State was really, really holding them. And this definitely looked like it could be a trap game of a team that they really didn't think they were going to struggle with, that they struggle with and lose an easy one to. But they did pull out the victory. We move over to Gainesville. Florida moved over, traveled up to Tennessee to play the Volunteers, and they dropped this one. That brings them down to 2-2 on their season. And this is the first time, this is actually only the second time since 2004 that Tennessee has beaten Florida. I mean, that's a very long time, and this is only the second time. And so head coach Billy Napier, his first season, he's really going to start looking at what is going on with his team. They're 2-2. They're 0-2 in SEC play. And so there's going to be a lot of questions being thrown around this week before they gear up for their next game. And it also drops them out of the top 25 rankings. And then we have Florida State, who are absolutely rolling right now. They're 4-0. They just beat Boston College, and they jump into the AP top 25 for the first time. And it's really great to see that program turn around. Mike Norvell, this was a year where he had to really prove what he was doing and that he was going to finally turn the program around. And it really looks like they've turned a corner. And then we look at Miami. They lost another game to Middle Tennessee State. So the state of Tennessee was not kind to our Florida teams this week. And during that game, their starting quarterback, Trevor Van Dyke, was actually benched because of his poor play. And this also dropped Miami out of the top 25. So we had some very good play by some teams and some other teams who are really going to be asking themselves a lot of questions over the course of this week.
All right, Josh Torres, always good to get your insights on sports. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And thanks to our fabulous team here at WJCT News. David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Catherine Hobbs, Isabella Da Silva, Jessica Palumbo, Randy Roguski, and the entire newsroom. And you guys, drop me a line anytime. Actually goes to all of us. FirstCoastConnect@WJCT.org. Let us know what's on your mind. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News. 89.9 Jacksonville. We are all riders on the storm this week. Stay safe. We'll have updates on Hurricane Ian and a lot more coming up tomorrow at 9 a.m. Make it a great day.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.